Welcome to the Minivate Gang Podcast, episode 330. I'm Steve Borsch, and I'm on with Tim Elliott.
Good morning.
Graham Thickens.
Hey, I thought you'd have surf music on today.
Oh, because you're getting rid of your Woody?
Day, yeah. I'm selling the Woody wagon, and coming to pick it up. Yeah, so I've got on my Woody Aloha shirt, and I'm going to kiss her goodbye today.
Well, sorry about that, but you're going to lose it.
It's going to Huntington Beach, California, Surf City, USA.
Yeah.
So that's a good deal.
Our buddy Phil is off, and we've got a guest today, so I think we should leap right into the Minnesota stories. How about, Graham, you during the whole startup weekend thing, there was Club E, that panel on drones, and then did you go to the IoT Minneapolis meetup on Thursday?
Yeah, I did. That was actually this week, so it wasn't, you know, over the weekend. They weren't really part of startup week. They were independent events. But yeah, on Wednesday, the first Club E to be held in St. Paul was over at the University Club. Great setting. And there was a panel of drone UAV experts, and that was kind of fun. There was a guy from the U and a guy from the local UAV club, and then Eric Taipal, who is the CEO of Centera, a new drone company, and then an agronomist, since a lot of this stuff is for farmers, you know, tracking crops and so forth. So that was cool. And then Thursday evening.
Oh, wait a second. I have one quick question about the drone thing. Was there any discussion about arming them with lasers to weaponizing the drones? No?
No.
Oh, okay. Just checking.
The funny comment by the CEO of Centera was that, you know, he calls them unmanned aerial systems. He's an engineer, former Lockheed Martin. And, you know, he said, you know, we tried calling them unmanned aerial systems, but like everybody wants to call them drones. So they won, you know, but of course drones has the negative, you know, war implication, but that's the word that everybody's using now. So, and then Thursday evening, you know, Patrick Delaney organized this IoT Minneapolis meetup, which was partially about drones and also about Google Project Loon. They had the guy from Google via video feed. I didn't stay for that, but there was a good talk about what Centera is doing with their drone software, and they showed their fancy fixed wing drone that's really cool. And there were about 100 people there at World Design, and a whole bunch of them brought their drones. So there had to have been, they weren't flying any when I was there, you know, but they could have in that big soundstage area, World Design. You literally could have flown drones around in there. I think they probably did before or after I left, but there had to have been 20, 30 drones there. Small to quite large. So it was sort of drone week.
Well, you know, and I'm kind of wondering about, you know, there seems to be, you know, a growing backlash against drones. And now there was a post that I read, maybe it was in City Pages or something, about the National Football League and specifically the new Viking Stadium being very concerned about people flying drones around the stadium. And now the Department of Homeland Security is looking at drones because they could deliver terrorist payloads. It's like, man, oh, man. Yep. So,
there are definitely strict regulations relating to, you know, consumer use of drones.
That are growing, yeah.
But the events this week were about commercial use of drones, you know, and they're really being applied quite widely for actual real business uses, you know, with real ROI, you know, in agriculture, in tower infrastructure, you know, inspections of cell towers and broadcast towers and wind turbines and public safety applications. So that was what the discussions this week were about. And then there were some very engaged audiences with a lot of great questions. So we'll be hearing more about drones in town here and beyond. But, you know, there's a ton going on up in North Dakota, too, in this regard, particularly ag, as you would expect.
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, you know, there's a lot of drone startups and a lot of stuff going on. And Tim, question for you. If you can't get your startup funded in Silicon Valley, where would you go?
I would go to Minnesota.
Oh, really? Does anyone else think that?
Apparently, this Terry Collins does at CNET. He wrote a really nice piece. I don't know. This seems so positive. And it's very nicely done. It smells to me like it could be a PR thing. I don't know. Well, I don't know who did it, though.
Yeah, we were trying to figure that out. Yeah.
It was just dripping with Minnesota love, you know, but, you know, complete with the great photo of Cocoa Grain Exchange. And but, you know, if you drilled into who this guy was, I went to his Twitter profile. He's a former Star Tribune writer.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't remember his name, but the guy obviously has a warm spot in his heart for Minnesota. It was an awesome story. I mean, he mentioned all the latest, hottest startups, mentioned our startup week last week and Minnesota Cup. And yeah, it's this story was passed around widely when it hit.
And you know, the one thing that sort of surprised me was the paragraph where he says Minnesota was ranked 20th in the country last year in receiving venture funding for tech startups. And the state trails Oregon, Utah, and Arizona by mere percentage points. California, of course, is ranked number one. But I thought, wait a minute, Oregon? I mean, I knew Utah because of the, you know, the technology hub that's around Salt Lake City, and Arizona because there is, you know, GoDaddy's there, and there's all these technology startups in the Phoenix area specifically. But Oregon?
Yeah. I mean, well, Portland's hotter. Hotter than a pistol, too. There's a lot of startups in Portland. But you know, those rankings of money raised, you know, they vary quite a bit from quarter to quarter and year to year. You know, and we aren't always doing real well in that regard. But we have our good quarters, that's for sure.
Yeah.
We've had some lately.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, I think we've got a real competitive advantage, though, because our children are above average. So anyway,
there you go.
let's talk about
all right, Garrison.
Let's talk about Target for a minute, because they just it's almost like every other week there's something coming out about Target and some of the things that they're doing. And Tim, you put some stories here in the show notes. Can you kind of recap them?
Well, they're both about the same. There's a Fortune piece that kind of gets into their new initiative, which is called LA25, which is rolling out in Los Angeles at 25 Target stores. And it's basically using RFID and just some other kind of signage to help direct people to products. So it's it helps their associates find products for customers, and it helps customers. So it's to be determined if this is going to be successful, and how it links into their beacon strategy is also unclear based on what I've read, but this is their latest attempt to try to differentiate themselves from Walmart and everybody else in their space.
Interesting.
Yeah, I'll tell you, their PR department has got to be in overdrive because the stories are just coming out constantly. And, you know, they announced that they're going to be piloting grocery delivery with Instacart in Minneapolis.
Yep. We talked about that.
I got a kick out of how that came out on the same day that there was a story about how Bill Gurley, who's, you know, the VC in the Valley, who keeps saying the bubble's going to burst. And he had said that he doesn't think Instacart's going to last, you know, like, it could be the next web van kind of thing. So I thought
I've read that in a couple of places. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, okay, well, the pilot, we'll see how the pilot goes, but don't hold your breath on Instacart, I guess, for long term. But who knows? Who can predict these things, you know?
Yeah. Well, everyone seems to think the world's going to end next week. So I don't know.
Wait, who thinks that?
What, you haven't seen this?
No.
Have you been on the internet? Come on.
I have been on the internet.
The 23rd or the 24th, a huge asteroid will hit the Earth and around South America, and it's going to set off a a global catastrophe.
Then it won't matter if the bubble bursts.
That's right. What? Well, the bubble will burst because of this.
It's no wonder. Oh, okay. It's no wonder that the Pope came to the greatest country in the world. Then
that's why he's here
to see us off.
That's right.
To see us.
Yeah. He'll be doing mass at Madison Square Garden. The whole thing will hit, and yeah, it's
interesting. No, I have not read that. What are you talking about?
Oh, it's a bunch.
All right.
If you're into conspiracies, this is a good one. It was so funny because the NASA, I'll have to pull out the link here, but NASA put out a press release, I think it was last week, saying there is no giant asteroid.
Oh, man.
they had to resort to a press release, huh?
Yeah. It's hilarious because it's picked up so much, currency.
Yeah.
And if you go to YouTube, there's a lot of crazy videos out there, let me tell you.
Oh, my God. Well, you know what I do sometimes just for fun is I have a stumble upon app on my iPad. And so sometimes just for shits and giggles, I'll pull that thing up at night and I'll start flipping through stuff like the humor category, or I have a conspiracy category, and then there's a UFO category, and I'll just flip through this stuff. And I got to tell you, there is just some stuff that is so out there, it makes Scientology look mainstream. It's just, oh my gosh.
Well, there's a lot of prophecy because, there's this, a lot of stuff meets up this month.
Okay.
In the Jewish calendar, and, it's people are like making all sorts of linkages.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm one that's going to say right now that we'll be on next week. That world will not end, or an asteroid, if it hits, it won't create a huge catastrophe. But there could be a startup bubble. I'm still worried about that.
Yeah. If that explodes, who knows? We may go into a nuclear winter type of thing.
But Target will still be around, right?
Yeah. All right. Well, Target will have to find another. Maybe they'll partner with Uber next or somebody to deliver their stuff.
Yeah, that could be.
So.
Or drones, Target drones.
There you go. All this drone for delivery stuff, it seems too Jetsons to me.
It does.
No?
Yeah. Yeah, of course, we're not living up in the sky yet, so.
Yeah, but I don't know. It just seems too fantastical.
Yeah. Well, listen, Graham, good catch on this article from the Post Bulletin that the Mayo, which is the Rochester, Minnesota main rag, that Mayo and the Star Tribune have formed a content partnership.
Yeah.
So that seems pretty interesting.
It was forged with one of the VPs. It's a major kind of sponsorship thing. And it definitely fits into that category we've all heard a lot about, native advertising.
Yeah.
So the journalism purists, and journalism ethicists are kind of shaking their heads going, oh boy, here we go, And they quote the Post Bulletin did a good job of getting commentary from different sources, including a journalism ethicist who said that, oh boy, this could be going down a slippery slope. But then he said, but it's the new journalism. So what are you going to do? They're going to have a ton of great graphs and infographics that are going to be appearing in the Sunday paper in the science and health section. And I don't know. What do you guys think? I pretty much trust Mayo's content. Don't you?
Well, I do. Yeah. I have concerns because most of their stuff is pretty vanilla. It's almost like it's been scrubbed and scrubbed and scrubbed by legal to say, no, you can't say that because then there's nothing to back it up with facts and blah, blah, blah. The one sentence in this entire article that sort of jumped out at me was, will the Strib be as tough in investigating issues that have a Mayo angle now that the exclusive sponsorship agreement's in place? And that's the whole background of this whole thing, or the whole reason for it. But it gets back to like television news. Most of the local news channels, how many times have people pointed out, the 75 news channels that ran the exact same story because they all got the same videotape?
Yep.
About some big deal story that they wanted to have out.
That's a big problem with television news, is that almost all television news has been compromised by native advertising. Even PBS, which probably is the best as far as trying to be non-biased, they still have problems with these, you know, with stories being planted that are clearly paid for. And print journalism, both magazines and newspapers, have seemed to be the last bastion of, you know, ethical journalism. And so this is troubling from that perspective. But it is Mayo, so I don't know.
Right.
It's not like it would be like Monsanto, let's say, or Cargill. That would that I think would be probably a little more problematic.
Yeah, it is, after all, a nonprofit. And I'm sure my friend Joe Carlson on the business page, who is the MedTech healthcare reporter, would say he's not going to back off, you know, and neither are the business editors there. They're going to still, you know, come out with stories if there's something negative on Mayo. I can't imagine what that would be, but, you know, they're going to tell you this isn't going to affect their coverage. I'll guarantee you.
Yeah.
They'll tell you that, you know. So anyway, it was interesting, though, that the two major brands, Minnesota brands, forging a pretty big-time agreement. So it's a good story. Yep.
Interesting. Well, one of the things that we talk about a lot, we talk about Minnesota and technology and so on, is the demand for people with software coding skills. And Graham, you set up a guest for this week's show. And why don't you say a little bit about Mark, and then we'll connect him up.
Yeah, I had the good fortune of getting a tour and a meeting with Mark Hurlburt, who is president and co-founder of Prime Digital Academy, which spun out from the Nerdery and officially kicked off earlier this year in their own space. I was over visiting with my old friend Tom O'Neill, who's now president of the Nerdery, and we had a nice update, and he said, "Oh, I got to take you over and show you Prime," and so we hoofed it over to the next building, and I got a chance to meet Mark and one of his lead instructors, and it's really amazing how this thing has come along. We'd heard about it. It was announced maybe last fall or something,
right.
Really kick in until this year, and they have three concurrent cohorts going on, which he can tell you more about. So yeah, bring him on.
That sounds good. Mark Hurlburt, president and co-founder, Prime Digital Academy. And sounds like Mark's on.
I am. Hey, guys. How's it going?
Good. How are you? Steve Borshier, and, of course, Graham Thickens is on, and Tim Elliott.
Excellent. Thanks, guys, for having me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for making us part of your Saturday morning.
Oh, no problem. It was like cartoons.
Yeah, it was fun being over there this week and getting to see your new facility and all the excitement going on there. Why don't you tell us about the genesis of Prime Digital Academy, how it got started, and why, and when you kicked off and all that good stuff.
Yeah, Prime is definitely an idea that's been kind of a long time in the making. I spent the last 10 years of my professional career at the Nerdery, and I was a developer with them. I ran their marketing team and their branding efforts for a while, and most recently I was the chief strategy officer there. But I had a chance to be involved in the leadership team for about 10 years, kind of seeing the transformation and kind of getting really soaked in what it's like to be a growing tech company, and really struggling with the ability to find talent and to be able to push kind of an organization forward when it's really powered by smart people. And you know, many, many times during during the growth there, we were like, we were being hamstrung by the challenge of finding, and not just the right people, but the right kind of people, people who shared the values of the organization, people who had kind of a similar approach to problem solving, and being able to kind of find that right set of people was you know, pretty consistently a challenge. And when I was in my last role as chief strategy officer, a lot of my effort and my time went thinking about how to solve that. And we had done apprentice programs for user experience, and that had really been eye opening for how we could, you know, with a base of talent, how an organization could start to actually generate new talent and be able to kind of contribute back to the ecosystem and not be just kind of entirely dependent upon pulling resources from everyone else, and kind of trying to experiment with models that weren't as much about slugging it out in the market and trying to, you know, steal and recruit and pull everybody away from everybody else. And the thing that really happened that launched Prime for real last summer was, you know, and it's one of those simple things that just takes you a while to figure out, was that, you know, I had been kind of trying to solve this problem within the nerdery. And the reality is that it's not a nerdery problem. It's a tech problem in general. And it's certainly a tech problem here in the Twin Cities.
Mm-hmm.
And so that really kind of that realization and being able to go from, okay, how do we solve this problem for the nerdery, to thinking about how do we solve this problem for the tech community, was a really great step. And it allowed us to hook up with people at the mayor's office, with people in the tech hire initiative at the Obama administration, and really start to look at it with a new set of eyes and give us a much broader scope and you know, and I think a much truer kind of alignment with what the vision of the idea was from the beginning, which is to you know, the core idea behind Prime is that the future is made out of software, that progress in almost every area of human endeavor is going to be really, really governed by the ability that people have to make progress in software. And something as important as the future of everything shouldn't be left to a small group of people who all think the same way. Prime is really about trying to bring more people into the software skill and into the software industry, so that we have a better future, so that there is, you know, a more people's interest, more people's empathy is better represented in the future of where we're going. And we just could not be more excited about the reaction that we've had from employers, from interested applicants. And it's been awesome.
Well, is the, you know, what's a specific person's outcome from going through the program? So, I mean, it's not to become a full-fledged engineer and knowing all the various languages and so forth, and is it you know, is the curriculum focused on specific outcomes that people will get to after 18 weeks, or how exactly is it structured?
Yeah, so we have I'll kind of start with the objective, then I'll tell you a little bit about how it actually works and the mechanics of it. So the objective and the kind of the dogma that we put out there is we're trying to make developer stem cells. Right. Our goal is to make people who have the potential to develop into a whole bunch of different things within the development industry, within software engineering overall. So we want to make people who have a skill set where they're employable, they can be working, but that they could go on to do more focused back-end development, more front-end development, more mobile development. They could do full-stack development. They can do a variety of different technologies if they want to. We're trying to kind of get them started and make that transition from paying to learn to getting paid to learn. And, you know, any software engineer worth their salt spends their entire career getting paid to learn.
Yeah, yeah. It's that application where, you're actually going to learn when you're trying to accomplish something. Versus exactly. Learning everything first and then trying to go out and accomplish something.
Exactly. And I think that's where our approach is really, you know, it's a kind of endemic to what we do. The structure of it, we do an 18-week program. So it's broken into, we kind of joke that it's broken into three halves. The first of those three is what we call pre-work. And that's a, a 6 weeks period, and that is prior to people showing up in class. And so one of the huge assets that we have in the program, and one of the challenges, is that we bring in a huge variety of people. So, you know, in a cohort, you can have somebody who has 2 years of software classes at a community college under their belt, sitting next to somebody who is a project manager at a tech company for 4 years, sitting next to somebody who quit her job yesterday as a barista at Starbucks, sitting next to somebody who's been a stay-at-home parent for the last 15 years. And the first six-week pre-work period, what it allows us to do is to allow all those different people to get their feet wet in the technology, to understand some of the basics before they come into the classroom. And that allows them to have a common language from the beginning. It allows them to build a level of confidence so that we don't have people sitting down next to somebody who might have more kind of base experience and feel like they're not in the right spot. And it just kind of allows everybody to come together in a much more constructive way.
I was going to say, do students, do they learn Objective-C or Swift or Android programming, or do you just give them the basis to then move on to those?
Yeah, we do a full stack software engineering curriculum that's based in JavaScript full stack. So we're teaching, as far as the what of the program, it's HTML5, CSS3, JavaScript, jQuery, Angular on the front end, and then on the back end, we're focusing more on Node and Express. Although, you know, we touch Happy, we touch other frameworks on the front end that are competitors to Angular as well. And then on the database side, we look at both object-oriented databases with Mongo and relational databases with Postgres and SQL. And that's kind of the core. So that's we're covering test-driven development, JavaScript tooling with things like Gulp and Grunt and Sass and CSS and things like that along the way. The objective, as I said, is to really use those not as a, for instance, in test-driven development, this is Mocha. This is how you do test-driven development. Here's the specific API. This is how you do it. It's more, this is what test-driven development is. This is why people do it. This is why it's important. This is the value that it brings. Here's a tool that we'll show you so you can practice doing that yourself. So our goal is definitely more around, it's not around churning out a bunch of Node developers at the end of the day. It's about getting people who understand the why of the tools as much as the what.
Okay, that was really huge because ironically, after you and I connected about getting on Skype, and after I'd sent the email about today, I saw this article in the New York Times that Udacity says it can teach tech skills to millions and fast. And I started to go through that, and I thought, okay, well, the primary objective here for them, it's vocational training. So it's I'm going to teach you X, and you're going to learn X. That's the outcome, right? Mm-hmm. But if you don't have any of the basics. I can teach you how to use WordPress so you can blog, but oh, by the way, if you can't conjugate verbs and create sentence structure in the right way, and you don't know anything about the English language, and you're using your your instead of your, you don't have any of the basics. Which is exactly what you're providing, right? I mean, you're giving sort of the depth and the meaning and the why, and plus with all the speakers and so forth, there's a lot of other color around what you're telling them and teaching them.
Yeah, it's definitely about giving people, those base skills that are employable. So the things that they need to know in order to get those first jobs. And we use JavaScript as a teaching language partially because of the ubiquity of JavaScript. I mean, if you go to a .NET shop, a Ruby shop, a Python shop, a Node shop, you name it, there's going to be JavaScript within their stack, and there's going to, it's going to be there somewhere. So we feel like it's a nice portable skill. It also, obviously with the rise of Node and backend JavaScript, it is becoming a larger player as a language. And it's also kind of a a bit of a kitchen sink language. So it gives us an opportunity to talk about a lot of different stuff that's relevant to both object-oriented and functional programming with one set of syntax and being able to kind of present a lot of those concepts side by side.
Well, so sure. I have one other quick question. I'm sorry, Graham. Mm-hmm. The other quick question has to do with assessment of a student. And so, you know, if somebody is functionally illiterate in math and, you know, they took high school algebra for 1 year and that was it, you know, are you assessing students so that you can essentially tell them whether or not they're going to be successful and, you know, if they're just interested in getting involved? I mean, how does that process work?
Yeah, so prior to the program admission and all the stuff that we've been talking about so far, we have a pretty robust admissions program. excuse me.
That's what I was going to ask about.
Oh, you were? Know, okay.
mention how many have applied to date. It blew me away when I heard the number.
Yeah, we're really, really fortunate that we've had a little over since we opened our doors and for applications in December of last year, in December of 2014, I guess that is. And we are extremely fortunate to have had over 1,100 people begin applications since that time, which has been awesome. We've admitted about 130 people. So it's allowed us to be really selective. The first part of that, the first kind of stage in that process is a pretty elaborate admissions program. So students generally spend about 12 hours, give or take, on their applications. And we have them do three things. There's essay questions, which, as you guys are mentioning, conjugating and being able to string words together is important, not just for blogging, but for developers too. So we're looking at their ability for written communication, their ability to make their, you know, formulate thoughts, be, you know, have a good conceptual groundwork for answering some questions about their future, about how they position themselves. The second is, we're talking about math. We've found that higher math skills are a lot less important than logic. Logic, and there are some other metacognitive abilities that are really important in programming. So we have a logic puzzle that we have them do that involves looking at things like pattern recognition, kind of testing people's abilities and some of kind of the innate things around like order of operations and stuff that are related to algebra, but also are really relevant in programming. So we do look at those things. It's a tool that we've developed internally. So, you know, we kind of take it with a grain of salt, but it's been so far a good indicator of people who seem to have a good head on their shoulders and we're ready to get the most of the program. The last thing that we do and the most time consuming thing, though, is we provide people with some resources that are from, you know, online sources and some additional stuff that we've developed ourselves. And we have them put together their resume for us as an HTML and CSS page and post it on GitHub. So for the developers that listen here, you know, they know that's relatively trivial. It's not like that's a technical feat. It's really much more about seeing how people follow directions. Are they able to do things and kind of dot the I's and cross the T's? We also set a bar for students and say, you know, you must do this if you're applying. And we also kind of show them some other stuff and say, oh, you could do something like this. And so it gives us a really great understanding of how they approach discretionary effort. Are they interested in kind of spending more time to do something that's more? Are they really getting caught up and excited in the passion of what they're doing and doing a little bit more? Or are they kind of getting to the finish line and, you know, stopping cold at that point? So those are the things that we do for the first pass, and then after that, for the students that have or applicants that have good scores at that point, we bring them forward to an in-person interview, and so we sit down with them for an hour, and in a lot of ways, that's really a dress rehearsal for a job interview. We're kind of looking at them and saying, you know, we're going to have 18 weeks with you. We can instill a certain amount of knowledge, a certain amount of skill, but some of this, you know, you kind of have to come in with. Some of it, we do things like Toastmasters. We do a lot of group presentation. We help people with their, with how they communicate and how they present themselves, how they can talk about code. But, you know, if they're not able to to feel comfortable speaking to somebody in an interview, we can't fix that over the course of 18 weeks. So we're really trying to find those people who can get benefit from the program and who we can help them get into the industry and help them find their way into the classroom. And we're working really actively with a number of traditional educational institutions, including Capella, North Hennepin Community College, St. Paul College, to try and find ways where if people aren't at that level where they're ready to benefit from a program like Prime, that we can redirect them back to other things that might be more what they need right now, whether that's stuff to help them work on their English, if it's things to help them work on basic logic or algebra skills and math skills and stuff. And be able to go from there. So we really do make an effort to try and help everybody figure out what the next step is on their path, even if it's not Prime.
Yeah, well, that all sounds great, Mark. And people should definitely go read more at primeacademy.io. Yep. One final question I wanted to ask you, and you kind of touched on this, but what geographic coverage of students are you looking for here? Are they mostly coming from Minnesota? And talk a little bit about the diversity of educational backgrounds, degrees mm-hmm. and so forth.
Yeah, we're really fortunate in that we haven't really done much marketing at all. The marketing that we are doing, we're doing in the local area. And that's really what Prime is about. I mean, I think our relationship with the city from the beginning was really founded on the idea that we don't want to be a boot camp that brings in people from all over the country, trains them here, and then sends them back to their geographies. Our goal is to help Right. contribute to the tech industry here in Minnesota. And so if people want to come here and they want to be here, that's awesome. We'd love to have them. And but for the most part, our hiring network that we're building, the efforts that we're doing to try and help people get into the market is here. And so we want to find people who want to be in Minnesota, which has been awesome. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, is it true you've actually accepted students everywhere from maybe a high school graduate to a master's degree holder, or how diverse is the educational background?
Yeah, educational background in terms of diversity, we have about two-thirds of our students have existing degrees. About 50% have a four-year degree of a BA or BS. About an eighth of our students have higher degrees, so a master's, a PhD, law degree, things like that.
And really? Wow.
Yeah, 5% have associate's degree, and then the remaining 30% have completed a college education or a high school education and typically have some college. And that's kind of a mix of people who are fresh out of high school, might be 19 years old, and then people who maybe went into retail and didn't follow a college path at that point, or had a family and have been stay-at-home parents or whatever, and are getting back into the field at this point. So it's a pretty big mix. Diversity, I guess, is a thing, something that's important to us. Obviously, we talked about the mission of the organization, but we're really proud that we have about 40% women in the program, which when you compare that to the about 8 to 15% women in the application development field, depending upon whose statistics you trust, we're really, really proud of. Mm-hmm. We're working on our ethnic and racial statistics. We're about par with Minnesota's numbers right now. We have about 5 to 6% Hispanic students, 5 to 6% African American students, 5 to 6% Asian students, but it is majority white, and that's about where we're at in Minnesota. We'd like to see those numbers improve, and we're working with the city to try and do a lot more outreach to communities of color to find ways to bring a more diverse face to the people who are at school and the people in the industry.
Great.
We appreciate you coming on.
Yeah,
Mark,
no kidding.
And telling us about it. I would encourage folks to go take a look and maybe try and get over there and get a look at your nice facility too. So
yeah, we're
best
we're,
of luck going forward and onward and upward, huh?
Yeah. Thanks so much for talking today. We're really excited to be be able to have this chance to talk to people in the community. We really are trying to build bridges. One of the things that we do in the program, I'll plug really quick, would it be relevant or should it be relevant for some of your viewers? the last portion of our program is project-based. And part of what we do with that is we try and bring in stakeholders from the community that are doing really interesting things to get them engaged with the students and have the students, when they're doing their projects at the end of the program, be doing pro bono work for really worthy organizations within the community. So so far we've done some really interesting things, and we have great partnerships with people like the Minnesota Cup and Social Venture Partners to help us find these organizations. Nice. So we're really excited to hopefully be giving back to the community and helping people do some interesting things with proof of concepts, with prototypes, with kind of internal projects that organizations are looking at as part of the chance to get people up to speed in technology. So,
awesome. Well, congratulations on your success to date, and I'm sure we'll be hearing about a lot more.
Yeah, thank you very much. Party. Thank you very much. It's great talking to you guys.
Take care, Mark.
Have a great weekend.
You too.
Wow,
what a great spokesman for the yeah. I mean, he's he knows everything about it, and he's pretty articulate evangelizing it.
Yeah.
So
yeah, and he does have a great background as a marketer and a brander. You know, I love the tagline on his business card. It just says Prime, and then underneath, code tomorrow. So
great.
You know, there's the benefit statement, you know.
Yep.
If you can qualify to get in, you know, I'm sure they'll be accepting more students going forward, but I didn't catch the exact number. Well, he might have said it. There's three concurrent cohorts now, and I forget how many students he said 110 or something like that. So no. It's a busy place over there.
Well, yeah. Any other tech stories? Anything that we think are a big deal? I mean, Facebook's dislike button, that's not really going to happen, is it?
It looks like it will, or some sort of empathy button.
Really?
I think this is might be the jumping the shark moment for Facebook.
Okay.
You think so?
Yeah, because it'll be the troll button.
It will be, yeah, yeah.
You know, people. I'm already concerned about Facebook because it's such a weird world where, you know, people are sucked in, and I mean, regular people are sucked into it, like other people are having these great lives. But it's that everyone puts on a happy face on Facebook, so you get a skewed version of what's going on. And by having a dislike button, it's just going to, the negative will come out, and it's going to make it just even more crazy. So,
yeah. Well, I've also read where it's like people need a different kind of button, because it's like when somebody's telling a story about how their poor sister is trying to recover from cancer or something, it's like you don't really want to click like, you want to just sort of, you know, like you say, show empathy for them. So it isn't like so much a dislike button is needed as just something other than just like, you know. But I don't.
That's what emojis are for.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Just stick an emoji on the comments. Come on.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, anyway. So what do you guys?
What's all this crap about the ad blockers? It seems like it's blown up on iOS.
Well, it has blown up, and in fact, my cool thing of the week was a blocker. So anyway, it blew up because suddenly the number one ad blocking app for iOS 9 was written by a guy named Marco Armont, and it was called Peace. And I'm saying was because he pulled it.
Yep.
And he wrote a whole article about why he pulled it, frankly. And yep. So,
did you guys get what his real motivation was there? Did he feel like he was really doing damage to the publishing industry or something, or what?
That's essentially what it is.
I don't think so. I think someone paid him off.
No.
You know, that's what I was wondering. I read the whole thing, and it's like, well, why is he actually doing this? Just because he doesn't feel quite right about it. You know,
it seems like someone came and said, hey, this is going to cost us a lot of money, so why don't you take all this money and pull your app?
Boy.
Yep.
Really?
Because this does make him look bad. I mean, you know, I'm not sure if I would buy whatever his next app is. You know,
knowing that he, well, he claims he's going to continue to support it for those that have it.
No, he says says that basically it'll work, but he's not going to update it. So
not going to update it.
Even if he didn't, even if he just updated the Ghostery database, that would still mean that it would be worth your $3. But he's not even going to do that. So I think it's. I think if that's what it is, I think that, you know, that what there was a firestorm that happened. And I think that the Gruber comment about blocking the deck, which is popular with bloggers because it's an ad network that is a kind of a minimal ad. I mean, they're very small and unobtrusive. So it's probably the kind of ad that if you're going to run ads, you want to run. And it blocks that, and he made a big deal out of that. So I think that's part of it as well. But did either of you buy this thing when it was out?
No, I bought. I bought another one that I put into my cool thing of the week, which I'm now changing. But
because you don't want to be that guy, huh?
Well, no. I mean, it's you know, I have unlimited data on AT&T, but I got to tell you, when I sit down with my iPad and I go to the New York Times or I go to Mashable. Mashable's the worst offender, and you start to read an article and you scroll down, all of a sudden the thing snaps back to the top because another ad loads. Then you scroll back and you start to read, and all of a sudden it snaps back to the top, and then all of a sudden you touch it to scroll and it launches the app store because they put this invisible transparent overlay over the article so that you touch it, and then obviously they get a click to click to pay, and it pisses me off so much. First of all, I stopped going to Mashable, but I do read the New York Times, and I like to read it on my iPad, and it's because of the damn ads and the way that they keep loading them and keep loading them and keep loading them and rotating them, and you can't. It just makes the site not functional.
Well, they want you to buy their app subscription so you can not have all those ads.
Yeah, but I mean, if somebody puts a link. And you click the link, and it goes pulls up the New York Times in the browser. It just is what it is, right? Yeah. I mean, it would be great to. And I do have a subscription to the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, but if I click a link, I want it to just open. So that's
I think that the root of the problem in the article that The Verge had, it's the web is getting broken, and it's just that the only way to make money is all this, you know, tracking and ad networks and all this kind of stuff. So it's we're at a real pivotal time, I think, and it looks like the big money is going to continue to, you know, have control. I mean, if Marco's thing, he hasn't really explained it well. I just dialed up the Accidental Tech podcast before we started, and I see he talks about it in the after show, which is kind of funny. So I'll need to listen to that to see if he says anything else on his podcast. But it just smells like, you know, he's dealing with very powerful forces, and they got to him one way or the other, either directly, i.e., getting paid off, or he was threatened with something,
guilting him.
Yeah, he just didn't feel right about it.
Or threatening with kneecapping or something.
Well, this was the number one app on the iOS App Store for both days that it was out, you know?
Yeah.
So
amazing.
Anywho.
Well, I'm loving iOS 9. But yeah, what else? I mean, there's we got a bunch of links in here, but we're quickly running out of time.
Right. So I thought that iOS 9 would probably be the last thing we talked about here.
Yeah.
So what do you guys think of it?
Have you had a chance to look at it a lot, Steve? It was a long download on all my devices.
Yeah, it was a long download, but it's I really like it. Obviously I don't have a fast enough iPad to be able to do split screen very well. You know, there is a little bit of lag when I'm trying to do certain things, but I do like the new San Francisco font. Believe it or not. I mean, it's functioning great.
So what kind of an iPad do you need to have to really benefit from the split screen? The iPad Pro?
Well, or a new A8 chip.
Yeah.
iPad.
So it's that's the Air, right? iPad Air.
Yeah, I'm not even sure what chip it has in there, because I'm not actively out shopping, so I suppose I should know this, shouldn't I? But the, you know, the iPad Pro will certainly have that in it.
Yep.
But
those big companies are certainly getting to like iPad Pros, right?
Sure looks like it. Well, yeah, you know what? The iPad Air 2, in fact, Tim, does have the A8X chip in it.
Yeah.
So
the latest iPad Air 2.
Yes.
Maybe not the early.
Will iPad it even Air 2. Will it run on the latest iPad Mini, which has the 4, which has the same chip?
I don't know the answer to that.
Is it is it size dependent? In other words, because it seems to me like running side by side apps on a little 7-inch screen would be, I don't know. That seems to be suboptimal.
Well, just remember though that the resolution is essentially the same. You know, the same aspect ratio and everything is scaled up and down based on the size of the iPad screen. And so it would work. I think it'd be kind of small, but
yeah, that's the problem.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, now that I'm going to get to my iPhone 6S Plus, hopefully in the next few weeks here, it'll be,
yeah, me too.
It'll be, I'm probably going to dump the iPad mini and get a bigger iPad.
Ooh.
Because I'll be carrying around, everybody I've talked to that has a 6S Plus has said they have stopped taking their iPad with them because the screen's so big.
Yeah.
And so
I stopped using a tablet when I got my large Android phone.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
yep.
Yep. It's the right size for almost, you know, for the things you'd use a 7-inch tablet for reading.
And right.
It may be a little productivity kind of stuff, but yeah. Well, maybe Steve, you should go and you should do what you tried to do with the original iPad, which is replace your laptop with it. Maybe you should just go, you know, sell your laptop as well and go all in on the iPad Pro.
It's going to be, no.
And get a pencil. You got to get a pencil to go along with it.
Well, yeah.
And then
I could see all of the art for the podcast here with Steve's drawing skills. that would be great.
Yeah. That's right. All I can say is none of the commercials have the disclaimer, artistic talent not included.
They
look fabulous with the pencil and these amazing artists drawing all this different stuff. I'm thinking, well, I can draw a square. And maybe a little stick figure, but it's like, oh man. Anyway, hey, let's segue to this cool thing of the week. Cause this is my favorite segment of the whole show. And, and Graham, let's start with you, buddy.
Well, you know, I landed on a weird thing. It's like anti-facial recognition glasses are now a thing. Apparently in Japan that it's been around, it's called the privacy visor. Huh. And it defeats, you know, facial detection software, which apparently Japanese folks are more aware of or more concerned about. And there was a story in Fast Company that these things are out there and I think, you know, are available in the U.S. So take a look at that if you're really, really into protecting your privacy out there on the public streets.
Well, I got to tell you again, I know I've told this story before in the podcast, but going back to my days at Vignette back in the early 2000s, and we had a partner, Viraj, who had facial recognition software that all the major broadcast networks in the world had bought into. And the facial recognition was so incredibly good then that they could, you know, you could type in, show me, you know, George H.W. Bush. All the video of him and it would go off and it would bring everything up. Of course, everything had to be indexed in advance, but the facial recognition was incredible. Well, now we see what's available through, you know, Facebook's facial recognition and Google's and so on. And, you know, just imagine all the cameras that are following your whereabouts. Where's Graham today? Yeah. He's at another event having some beer.
Yes, I will be.
He's in our beer database. Okay. Anyway.
Yeah. So, Tim, what's your thing?
The Orange Pi PC, which is another one of these Raspberry Pi-style single-board computers. But what's notable about this one is that it's $15 instead of the $25 or $35, depending on which version of Raspberry Pi you get.
Wow.
So for $15, I think it's worth checking out. And it's purportedly supposed to be compatible with Raspberry Pi, so you can run a lot of the Raspberry Pi images for things like OpenELEC and Raspbian, which is their version of Debian Linux. And so I think I'm going to give one of these a try. It looks like it's slightly clocked. It's clocked higher, and it's capable of handling 4K video, which the Raspberry Pi is not.
Well, but, and it has an integrated microphone. So
it does.
That's really amazing. For $15.
Yeah, you can run Android on this. So if you did Android, you could use the OK Google commands that Google now has built in.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Talk about cheap, geeky fun, man. That doesn't get any better than that.
Yeah. This is a computer revolution, the single board computer stuff. Hmm. So in a few years, we're going to see a lot of crazy computer innovation, I think, because, you know, if I had a kid that was, you know, 10 or 12 or whatever, they would have all this stuff to screw around with.
Yep. Wow. There you go.
Anyway.
Well, mine was an ad blocker, but I changed it on the fly while we were recording this show to a movie I watched last night, a documentary. I was poking around the iTunes movies, you know, the movie store at Apple TV. And they've got a whole crap load of documentaries for 99 cents. Not that I'm cheap, but I thought, what the heck, you know, I'll maybe learn something. And my bride was out. And so I watched The Rise and Rise of Bitcoin. And it was
really. What does that mean?
It's a movie.
Why are there two rises in it?
Well, because that it's continuing to rise. What's interesting is I thought that I thought that I really had my head wrapped around Bitcoin, but I'm realizing how much I don't know, and specifically how hard it is now to have mining be profitable, Bitcoin mining. But really a fascinating documentary, and if you want to get up to speed on Bitcoin, at least get a sense of what's going on, this is a great film to watch, and it's a buck.
Hmm. Get your Apple TV, and you're all set.
There you go.
Well, it's available elsewhere, but...
Yeah.
Maybe for $2. I don't know. Or maybe five Bitcoins. I don't know. Of course, a Bitcoin, one Bitcoin now is over $200.
Boy, that's dropped a lot, though, from the glory days.
Yes. Yeah. It was over $1,000 at one point, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I remember it was hovering around $600-$700 for quite a while. It's only $200 and something now.
Yeah. As we're recording right now, US dollar, Bitcoin equivalent is $231.97 per Bitcoin. So
there you go.
But yeah, I mean, if you're not willing to, you know, I look at this whole thing as being unbelievably risky. And, you know, I can barely trust our own financial system, especially Wall Street. So trusting the efficacy of Bitcoin and the network and blockchain and all of that is, I'm not
scary.
I'm not concerned about the technology itself, but you know, the caveats, it's definitely for way early adopters. It's not even, you know, I would not recommend that anybody who's not willing to do a ton of study even touch, because boy, keeping yourself private and secure and keeping your Bitcoin wallet secure, that this stuff is not trivial. So
we don't recommend this for the average Minovate listener.
We do not. Not at all.
We don't want the legal liability here, baby.
Yeah. Well, hey, I notice in the show notes that some young man on this podcast got a press pass to the Minnesota Venture Conference on October 1st.
Yeah, I'm going to be there covering it for Minovate.
Nice.
And I've attended over the years off and on, but it sounds like a pretty good lineup this year. Lots of good startup pitches. So yeah, that's all day. What is it? Thursday, October 1st, I think. Yep. So that's going to be cool. And then there's a bunch of other stuff too. Are you guys going to any of the others coming up here? Open Source North?
Open Source North, I'm not sure I can go to, but the IoT Hack Day on October 17th is a definite one. And then I'm going to try to get to the Converted 2015, the Lead Pages Conference.
Yeah, that'll be good.
That'll be a good one. So,
and we have to note that all of this stuff and the entire upcoming events is after the world is supposed to end. So
that's right.
These events may or may not happen.
So there's Tim Elliott's doomsday caveat.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I could be right.
May we suggest paying on site instead of prepaying?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Although
I'm
going
to go to IoT Hack Day if the event is on.
Bitcoin when you get there.
Yeah.
No, pay in cash, pay credit card, whatever. Pay Apple Pay. But I'll be at the free ones like Mini Analytics on the 23rd. That's filling up fast. That'll be 1,000 plus people at Optum Eden Prairie.
Yep.
And then MEMA Summit, which is definitely not free, is October 15th. Did you guys get invited to the VIP party the night before?
No, because we're not very important. So
because we're not.
Well,
VIP.
I got an invite. I'll have to send that to you if you want to show up for that. I might. I don't know.
Here's a disclaimer. Graham believes that he's a very important person. So.
Well, he is apparently.
I guess.
I don't know why. I don't know why I got it because you know we didn't talk about trying to cover that event, but could have been a mistake. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, they anyway. Know that you like beer, especially when it's free.
Well, we'll put the rest. We'll put the rest of the stuff in the show notes here, and we will cover that and a lot more next week on
the Minivate Gang Podcast.
All right.
Yeah, see you next week if the world doesn't end.
Take care.
That's right. And it's homecoming next weekend. Gophers. And they're playing today, too.
Take care.
So, see you guys then.